my God, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Hey Kids Comics. We have, and I don't, we're going to descend into madness tonight in ways that I don't know if we ever have.
We're going to descend harshly. We're going to put our toes into madness.
I was unprepared.
We're actually going to go to the shallow end of madness.
The shallow end of madness.
Because we have designs on the big, you know, the big diving board, the one with the, like, 10 steps up to the top.
Yeah.
Not that one, the ground level one.
No, not even the one in between that one.
Yeah, not the platform on the way up.
No, this is, we're going up top for something big in the next couple of weeks, but...
Yeah. For right now, we need to test the water, and we also, we had that snack half an hour ago.
Right. Yeah, so we did. We can't
go all in just yet. Because
we got to keep our feet on the bottom of the pool for now.
Because this subject is one you don't want to dive into the hairy middle of, and literally the hairy middle of, on a full stomach.
That's right. We do creator spotlights here. We've done Jack Kirby. We've done, I believe, John Byrne.
We did do John Byrne.
I don't think we couldn't not do John Byrne. We've done some really big ones, but we started kicking around an idea for one, and none of us were prepared for what we would find at the end of the Dark Rainbow.
We have not done a creator spotlight on John Byrne.
Have we not? Who have we done? No. What is wrong with us?
I don't know what happened. Our first creator spotlight was Frank Miller.
Yes, it was.
The second, which was way back in February of 2013.
Wow, 2 years ago, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, then in September of 2013, Bill Willingham.
Oh, that's right, Billingham. That's right, Willingham.
Willingham. And then in April of 2014, after a massive hiatus on the project... Jack King Kirby.
We did a Kirby episode, and this
one. Now we are back with the fourth. Apparently, John Byrne will be number five. By God.
And the thing we can't do for whatever reason, what we can't do is, I think this has to do with the topic of our show. There are lights flickering where I am. There's an odd green mist rolling in under the door because tonight. We discuss the madness that is Alan Moore, and how waited 2 years to do this one is beyond me. Besides the fact that I don't believe we were able to until it's like when the student is ready, the master will appear. I don't think that we were ready to do a show on Alan Moore until now.
I think at this point they built it and we came.
That's exactly right. The beard beckoned.
Well, we had been wished into the cornfield or wished out of the cornfield or something, but we're...
Under the cornfield. I'm not real sure how you get there, but we're there.
Yes, indeed. Perhaps some introductions are in order.
Right? Yeah, I think so. If you don't know, this is Hey Kids Comics. This is issue 130. My name is Andrew Farmer, as always, and with me, as always, is the Jedi Cole Houston.
Which I'm having some tremendous beard shame.
We all have beard shame.
I cannot produce a mountain of facial hirsutedness of one Alan Moore.
And it doesn't. I mean, I don't think you can change it. You can't modify the beard. You can't shave it. You can't touch it. It just grows back. The man is a magnificent angular beast.
It's like one of those paper towel dispensers where you have to grab the bottom
right, of
the last towel. So if someone were to come and assault him at a convention and just chop the thing off wholesale, he would nearly need to grab with a firm grip of the thumb and forefinger on either side. Give it a nice, you want to give it a little, you know, primer yanks, you know, tear.
Right, right.
And then just give it a good firm pull and it's back.
And it's back, yeah. There's just no...
That is one of the legends of Alan Moore. He's not as replete with them as Chuck Norris, but there are some telling legends.
Well, the Chuck Norris ones are all like, you know, I don't even know any of the Chuck Norris ones, but there are plenty. Like, why wasn't Chuck Norris in Rambo? Because nobody would pay $8 to see a 9-minute or $12 to see a 9-minute movie or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Chuck Norris doesn't get up with the sun. The sun gets up with Chuck Norris.
Right, like, well, why doesn't Alan Moore go to conventions anymore? Because he literally will kill everyone. Not the same. It's just not the same. But
no, the reason Alan Moore doesn't go to conventions anymore is that the last convention he was at, all that was left was a ball pit.
That this, and it was,
they don't talk about what really happened there.
And it was human skulls. Yeah. It had the same consistency and buoyancy as balls that you would find in a ball pit. Yeah. We could sit here. Yeah, it's horrifying. But so not only are all these things true that we're going to say tonight, regardless of what we make up, he wills them true.
That's right.
He's also probably. The most influential comic book writer for Cole and I would say, outside of, you know, your Jack Kirby's and your stuff like that, you know, I would say modern comic writer of our time. And there are people out there, I saw recently there was an argument about whether he was overrated or not. I don't think that you can even rate Alan Moore.
I think if anything, he's underrated.
Yeah, well,
because there is no scale that can touch him.
But he's also underrated by his own machinations.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, he doesn't want to be rated. He's the mad monk that, you know, lives in the castle and never wants to be seen.
He's the unrateable.
The unrateable Alan Moore. So Cole, why
Alan Moore?
Why Alan Moore for
one
you?
May ask.
For you. For personally, for you, why?
Personally,
Alan?
For me, I kind of stumbled on Alan Moore. I can't say entirely by accident. It was almost like an accident by design. And in the past, when I've talked about, yes, here it comes, Watchmen.
Well, we were diving deep into Watchmen here.
There was going to be some Watchmen discussion. You can't talk about Alan Moore and not. It's like Lay's and eating one. The thing about it is, the first. I sort of have accidental encounters with Alan Moore because my first comic shop, Duncanville Bookstore, in Duncanville, Texas, carried back in the day Warrior Magazine, which is where Alan Moore's earliest known works. There were some early Alan Moore cave paintings found in LaCroix in France.
Yes, of course there were.
But they don't count because they were actually paintings, not prose or graphic fiction works.
They were poo-pooed by the comic community.
Yeah,
so.
They really, it's sort of the salon de refusé of comics.
Wow, you're classing up the joint.
Yeah,
tonight.
We are indeed. There you go. It was a degree well purchased. So, in the meantime, I do remember seeing this Warrior magazine, and there was some guy in a blue jumpsuit popping up out of the water, and some half of the drama and tragedy masks that were at the end of every Three Stooges alternately on the covers of this magazine I'd seen. It was just like, oh well, it's in pounds. I don't even want to know how much that's going to cost.
Yes,
they're selling comics by the pound, but
it's just
yeah.
But in comic terms, that's pushing weight. That's what we call it.
Right. So, you know, it would be it would take till Marvel UK started bringing plasma over to really get turned off again to British comics. But in all seriousness, you know, I had seen these things without really knowing what they were. So fast forward to the 80s, and at this point, one of our past actual spotlight recipients... None other than Frank Miller was making a huge splash, after which my only previous encounter was my friend and occasional contributor on some of these shows, Steve McCauley, complaining about how he wasted 75 cents on that damn Daredevil issue that was nothing but 112 panels of a fight scene, 110 of which just had onomatopoeia.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be until the death of Human Torch that you would get ripped off that badly by a comic book. So, and if you've read, you know, two-year-olds can read that issue of Fantastic Four. I'm going to say that. I'll go on record saying that. All that was missing was sort of a little cutout with a Pat the Bunny and maybe like some hot coals in there every time you touch the Human Torch. But this is going way...
It's Alan Moore. It's Alan Moore. Control it. There's no rails on this show.
Yeah, it's like you've been touched by a tentacle off the face of Cthulhu. It infects you.
You've opened the Book of Haster and it sucks you inside of its. There's no. Just don't even try to.
Yeah, just go with it.
Yeah.
Just go with it. So, you know, it's almost like, you know, all of a sudden Marvel has, or DC, you know, puts out The Dark Knight Returns, and comics have changed forever. And then Alan Moore just comes along and drops the mic.
Right, exactly. I mean,
he just
right.
walks out on stage and drops the mic. And that's enough. He wins the competition. It's like 8 Mile. It's just, he's over.
Wow, that is another. Cole, what have you been studying off camera? Like, you just have a... You're like, what can I say tonight to fold into this conversation? Do you have a calendar?
That's right. I watched some show about the demise of MTV or something. I don't know what that was. But, yeah, you know, it doesn't even have to do anything. He just comes in and says, oh, yeah, how quaint. I've only been doing that for the last 15 years.
Right, I've been reinventing this world since you've been in diapers, boy.
Yeah, that's right. Well, while the colonies are out drooling over the up-and-coming Mr. Miller.
Yeah, right.
Your true lord and master was already redefining. And even, I think Frank Miller even said that even the cave paintings trumped him.
Right, right. No, yeah.
So, it was truly a sad day in Muggerville.
It's always a sad day in Muggerville.
That's actually a bumper sticker.
Right.
It's always a sad day in Muggerville. But anyway, so they, you know, all of a sudden here's Watchmen. And I the thing is, I knew about Watchmen well before it came out. I think I talked about it before. There was in the Direct Currents or whatever the DC thing was.
Yes. I think it was Direct Currents, yes.
Things, and it was like, here's what's coming up from DC, and here was this thing that just, I was fascinated, because I was familiar with the Charlton characters.
Right.
From Crisis on Infinite Earths, and here were some characters that put you in the mind of the Charlton characters, but they weren't there. Well, the question was unquestionably there, as far as you knew.
Right.
Looked an awful lot like him for some reason. They just couldn't just give him the pasty, fleshy face there. They had to kind of,
I think it would have been creepier with, you know, and we've discussed this before, and I'm sure you have, that Rorschach, with the ever-evolving test that, you know, existed on his face, told a better psychological story than just the creepy Slenderman face that exists on the question.
So, exactly, because, you know, with the blank face, you would have to tell enough of a different story.
Right.
You would have to tell the same story in a much different way, because it would be very difficult for, you know, anybody to... You couldn't convey a lot of what was conveyed with that ever-changing face.
Right.
But anyway, this thing comes along, and I'm pretty sure that's the question, but here's a guy who's like the cousin of Blue Beetle. the owl fetishist to his insect fetishist. So, you know... It was just an intriguing thing called Watchmen, and there was precious little information given. It's just like, here it is, here you go. have it. Here it is, fanboys, eat it up. And so, you know, the dissemination of information back then was not as steady and unstoppable as it is today, of course. So, you know, you wound up having to just wait. And so about the time that I'm hearing about how great this Dark Knight thing is, and I'm going to Lone Star Comics to get my, actually went with Steve to get autographed, and I decided, well, I'll go ahead and jump on the bandwagon. This thing's like $3.50. Good God. The cover price was. But, you know, there was just such an air of excitement around this, and then I also, Watchmen had come out. About that same time, I believe. And so it's just like, okay, this is, you know, hello. So, you know, everything had changed through the efforts of those two. But in so many ways, Moore really went way beyond, because Miller was trying to tell a whole different kind of story, and it oftentimes allowed himself to be a little tongue-in-cheek, like with the Dr. Ruth on steroids character.
Right.
Things like that. So... You know, Moore said, I'm going all in. And it's going to be insanity. And
right.
So, you know, when you get something like that going on, then I'm hooked. And then comes the point where you're like, okay, what's next? You know, where else can I? Where do I get more? How do I get? I need me some more.
Can I get some of that sweet Watchmen?
Yeah, I need some more. And you know, I really don't know how I came by the first comics. I believe it was publishing the Miracle Man.
Okay,
had brought that over and adapted it unflinchingly. As one would find out, I think because that was starting to get a lot of press. It's like all of a sudden, oh wow, this is a thing. So I think that's how I got into that. And little by little, you know, the better comic shops you would wind up in, and be like, oh, you like Alan Moore, do you? Well, here, let me unload this on you. But you know, some of the stuff was pretty amazing. So you know, little by little, we were finding more of his work.
Right, and I think that ties into mine as well because I'm a little different than you. I didn't go out and I had, you know, I really wasn't aware of Watchmen in a big way until much later in my comic career, and I did not assimilate to it as quickly as you did or a lot of more serious comic fans did. I was very much Cape and Cal comic books, you know, for most of my young life. I would say probably 15 years of half of my comic book reading. I attribute more to my opening of my mind opening comic book experiences. You know, of course I had crossed paths with Moore before, before my later years. You know, the Swamp Thing, the Superman work, the Green Lantern work, his spattering here and there of you know stories that he had written, various things. But some of the, you know, because by the time I was getting into it, you know, the Vertigo stuff was pretty well instituted, and you could read him. You know, the John Constantine Hellblazer stuff was out there, and I had read a couple of those. But it wasn't until I picked it up as a collected, and I think it might have been the first thing I've read that wasn't a real Cape and Cowl comic book was League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yes,
the first one, and I was at a comic book shop, and keep in mind this was around 2000, so this was only 15 years ago, so literally about halfway through my reading, and I'm like, well, this looks really interesting. I should pick it up and check it out and see what it's about. The characters, you know, I know who Quartermain is, and I know who, you know, obviously I was a fan of sci-fi through, if you've listened to the show ever, you know that, you know, my dad really invested in the sci-fi thing for me at an early age. So, you know, you had Captain Nemo and Jekyll and Hyde and the Invisible Man and
yeah, and there were enough familiar faces that you didn't have to know everyone. Like, you didn't have to know that in Jules Verne, Nemo was Indian.
Right, you didn't. Because, and again, if you ever were
but you
watch,
found that out.
Yes, if you ever will watch a 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea movie, it was always played by like Gregory Peck is. It's like never an Indian dude.
Or James Mason.
James Mason.
I can't say James Mason without doing that kind of, like you have to square your jaw up like a big brick.
You literally, it's the Godfather thing. You have to stuff your mouth with cinnamon in order to say James Mason. But
yeah, you have to do that collegiate cinnamon challenge thing while simultaneously saying
James Mason. But the whole thing, I picked it up and started reading it, and you know, I bought it, and I'm like, okay, this is going to be, you know, the further adventures, but they're all together. So it's like the Avengers of these kind of, you know, silent movie era, black and white, War of the Worldsian type.
Exactly.
Type
and it
thing.
Was one of the earliest. I don't know that, I can't say that it could necessarily have claimed to be the first.
Right.
Mashup.
Of this,
but certainly everybody started doing mashups like this. All of a sudden, it's like, oh yeah, because I think prior to that, certainly you could argue that Captain Carrot and his amazing zoo crew in the Oz Wonderland War had already attacked the whole concept of you know, taking on public domain,
right,
and helping itself. So,
but it was different. And it was different because it was, and it's not different because it was mature. I had read mature comics before, you know, and I'm not talking, I'm not talking like mature, what was the name of the like I'm not talking like Lady
not
Death,
like
mature.
Time Wankers or
oh. Right, like
oh, that's even more
like
mature.
Fritz
there.
The Cat mature. I'm talking like you know, this was an adult comic book. This was a comic book that was written for adults with extremely adult themes, which we'll get into later, because you can't have an Alan Moore, you can't spell Alan Moore without rape,
that's the top of the show.
You had the weird, and you got to see, and this is where I started discovering, and we've talked about this before, the breadth and scope of the way that Alan Moore writes, and the angles at which he'll approach a story that you had never thought of before.
Oh, exactly. I mean, at the time, I was still, that was early enough, by the 80s, I was still an aspiring comic writer. And Steve and I had created whole pantheons of characters. And over time, that whole process was evolving. You know, I went from just it was enough to have the characters to where I started, you know, looking at some of what I'd written in notes and thought, this is rubbish. This is like kiddie garbage. You know, there were better written Fawcett Captain Marvel stories than some of the crap I was coming up with. And I was prepared to just let it all go. And then I started had this inspiration, like, okay, it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be everything you've already seen. So I started taking a little bit different approach. And then along comes Watchmen, like, okay. Then I got really dark for a while. So it became like, you know, with the success of The Dark Knight, all of a sudden Warner said, okay, we can't do Captain Marvel because that's fun and light. And like now they're beating the drumhead of, well, you know, Marvel movies may be great, but ours should be dark and gritty and awful. And it's like, no, everything doesn't have to be. But for a while, I went through that period where I was writing some stuff that I often don't even share with anybody because it scared the hell out of me.
But, you know, you always wondered if you had the power of... And you know, it was explored a little bit in the actual short stories. But if you had the power of invisibility, what would you do with it? How crazy, how far removed from reality would you get, you know, away from your own humanity? The same goes for Dr. Jekyll and you know, the Mr. Hyde aspect of Dr. Jekyll. And that's one thing that Alan Moore writes the inhuman more human than anyone, and the human more inhuman than anyone, and you got a glimpse of that in this, and all of a sudden I was hooked. I was hooked on the works of Moore at that point.
You really understood human nature and how when you cast off the shackles of society, as it were, there are, you know, some look at society as being like the one thing that separates us from the beast, and the reality is it's the one thing that separates some of us from the beast, except they're more shrewd about how they're a beast. They're still a beast, even under the guise of humanity. And, you know, once all that's set aside, then they become more of, if anything, you become more of what you are in a situation like that. And I think that's what we're in the appeal to kind of go a little off topic. That's the appeal of the stories in both the comics and the television show based on The Walking Dead.
Right.
Is that it explores the fact that in the worst of situations, you simply become an exaggeration of everything you ever were rather than just everything collapsing into chaos.
And Jefferson Harris, a friend of the show, actually just made a really good point on Facebook on this topic. And he, in reference to Cole's image that he made of Boromir saying, one does not simply walk into the Mordor.
Door.
Yeah, I hate you and love you at the same time. Jefferson says
actually the opposite about you.
Jefferson Harris says Alan Moore simply operates at a different symbolic frame of reference than the rest of us, and that couldn't be
more true.
Like that is perfectly and scoped.
Good timing to have brought that up while we're recording the show.
Exactly. It's like we have a call-in that wasn't a call-in. Thank you, Jefferson, for calling in. That's a very valid point. But no, the thing is, I've studied the Joseph Campbell, you know, hero's journey narrative arc, which has been used, you know, through time immemorial to tell stories. Lucas
back when it was simply known as the arc,
right?
Back in the classic, the days of the classic, we just simply called it, you know, what we normally get.
Your Lucas used it. Before that, you know, your spaghetti westerns. Before that, your sitcoms use it. Your samurai films and stories have used it. All the way back down through time, he just identified it and quantified it. Now, I don't think, and I would love to have this conversation on a later show.
What?
Sizzler reel.
Could be something bigger in the works.
I don't think that he uses the same methodology. He does, but he does it in that very Alan Moore way that takes what you know and perverts it in the best way possible. You know, like what he's done on Swamp Thing and what he's done with the Green Lantern. He'll take your idea of the hero's journey and just completely twist it. And
yes.
And you won't know which way it's coming from. And it's always, he's a brilliant writer beyond anything. Like,
one of the things he does very well is to take the worst of, you know, the most immoral and the worst, most terrible characters and find their nobility.
Right.
And give you the progression of the most noble and perfect into darkness.
Exactly.
And show you that it can be just a very simple step in one direction or the other.
He can break down and the thing that so since we've kind of moved out of our favorites and into the idea of Alan Moore, the you know, the pathos that is, he can take a character. I hate Superman. Okay, and I've said it before. I think that I think 99% of the time it is a boring character. I think that it's
well, certainly
lame.
Because the problem with Superman is that when you can do anything, why do you not do anything?
Right. So what you have when you have Moore is you have a character like Superman that he can break down to a molecular level and then rebuild into something you never expected. And he did that quite literally in Swamp Thing. It wasn't a metaphorical molecular disintegration. He literally broke Swamp Thing down to the molecule. And when he was recreating the Swamp Thing, because before Alan Moore, Swamp Thing was just it was the Man-Thing, Swamp-Thing analog before Moore got a hold of Swamp-Thing.
Well, it was basically an articulate Man-Thing.
Right. It was a...
I mean, unlike Man-Thing, who has to just sort of shamble around and hope somebody's like, I think he's trying to tell us something.
Right.
He could actually, because I am trying to tell you something, he is trying to tell us something. Like, okay, shut up or I will kill you with moss. And, you know, that's the thing. Is he took that idea and said, why not take this character everywhere, anywhere? There are so many places you can go with this if you step away from the traditional horror monster, you know, woe is me, tortured soul creature thing running around scaring people.
Right.
You know, Swamp Thing was elevated out of the Casper the Friendly Ghost camp. And taken to a whole new, he was taken into literature, basically.
Right.
It was no longer a Harvey comic on steroids. It became high art. And quite brilliantly, what he did was to leave Swamp Thing in a state where he had to grow out of, literally, his former self.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, that's... What better way to, you take a kind of phoenix effect where you just destroy, destruction before rebirth, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, is he used Swamp Thing as this prism, this cipher, to tell all these classic stories, all these amazing, amazing stories that you've heard 1,000 times or have seen 1,000 times, or you've read 1,000 times, and turn them completely on their ear and tell you a story that you knew in a way that you never knew it. And that's the brilliant thing about Alan Moore. Like, just another one, if we're telling these stories, if we're getting into the stories we're telling, you've got From Hell, which, again,
yes,
takes a classic story that we all think we knew, you know, an idea that we thought we knew. Because another thing about Moore is he is obsessed with conspiracy theories, which shouldn't shock anyone.
No.
He is absolutely...
I mean, if you boil down most of his work, there a lot of it is kind of all about conspiracies of some kind. You know, General Sunderland in the early days of Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
And then much later, you know, a very active conspiracy to rid the world of Swamp Thing, only to get him back.
Right. But you look at From Hell. We take the story of Jack the Ripper. We take the story we all knew, and we make it into a mystery. You know, you make it. What was the quote that I had told you earlier? What did he call his writing? I'm trying to remember. It was
That's right. Good night.
I'm dropping the ball. I'm dropping the ball on what he called his writing. But he tells a mystery. He's just a brilliant writer. I mean, that's what he is, and he makes you uncomfortable.
Yes.
And that's brilliant too, because the thing about a comic, and Alan Moore, I will say this, Alan Moore in his prime would not be able to function today.
No.
Because you would not be able to do From Hell the way he did it. In his vision, you would not be able to do League of Extraordinary Gentlemen in his vision. You would not be able to tell The Killing Joke in his vision if the internet existed the way that it does now.
Exactly.
He would get Menard left and right. He would be.
Oh yeah, he
pinballed.
Would be, and the thing is that his timing was such that he becomes legendary in the nick of time.
Right.
Literally allowing him to get away with everything that would follow. You know, it's like, that's terrible. No, it's Alan Moore. Oh, okay.
Right. Oh, it's Alan Moore. All right. Yeah. So it's passable.
Case, yeah. Don't worry. It's just Alan Moore.
Alan Moore also, it should be noted, was one of the first extremely successful independent authors. You know, spinning out of like the Image type thing.
Yeah.
But Image had a real company to fall back on. Alan Moore had his beard and his writing, and that's it. And he made it work. He did
exactly.
It. Exactly. Through sheer force of will. So we're about halfway through the show, and I think maybe we should talk about Alan Moore in media at this point. I think maybe that would be a good idea.
Yeah, I think that one of the perhaps unintended consequences of success can often be that everybody wants a piece of that action.
Right.
And I think that's ultimately what you're looking at with Alan Moore is, you know, here's this amazing body of very celebrated work. Here's a man who, I think more so than any other creator out there, brought comic books repeatedly into the spotlight and was one of the reasons it became okay to read comics, and it was never more proven, speaking of the media
right
approach, than the adaptation of Watchmen to the big screen, which took a long-ass time. Considered unfilmable from the outset. And you have to be careful what you wish for when you wish for the unfilmable, because look what happened to George R.R. Martin.
That's true. That's
you
true.
Know, reportedly disgusted with working in film and television, he set to work on the Game of Thrones mega franchise, the Infinitilogy, if you will.
Yes. It is the song that never ends. It's the song of ice and fire that never ends.
Take that, never-ending story. I got something for you.
That's right.
It truly is. But, you know, that it was, he set out to make the unfilmable story. There was no way in hell. This is so layered, so full of things that would be impossible, untenable. If you had unlimited resources and the kind of ransom demand money that mad, you know, specter leaders try to extort from the world, you still would not have enough money or resources ever in 10 lifetimes. If you're like the pharaohs and you set about on your fifth birthday to have somebody build your tomb, you would be done quite happily and, you know, they're inspecting the results and could die happily before that damn Game of Thrones film, which was $16 trillion over budget, was even ready to go into post-production. So I'm painting a very broad picture
you
here.
You Bob Rossed that so
yes,
hard.
Indeed. I just put in some little...
Happy little trees in there.
Little trees here and a little mountain. And oh, what the hell? Have a stream. What's a mountain without a stream and some flowers and Krakatoa.
Krakatoa.
And a dragon. But, you know, this was literally considered, this is impossible. It's too broad. You'd have to do a TV miniseries, and who the hell would touch that? And the list goes on and on. Then all of a sudden, technology caught up to us.
Right, and you can do things that you
never could. It was possible to do glowing schlongs. And,
oh, my God, yeah.
I mean, I would remove my name from the picture just on the dork alone. But I mean, you know, this went from Dave Gibbons to... oh, God, what was his name? There was a heavy metal artist back in the day who created a character called Dan.
Oh, no.
With the, I mean, he literally had the movie Schlong for from the outset. And they adapted that story in the animated heavy metal movie. But, yow. So... pissed off. I cannot remember the guy's name. But
it's okay. That's what the internet's for. Somebody will find it later.
That's right. Oh, by the way, you were talking about Richard Corbin, Cole. You of all people should know that. But yeah, look up Richard Corbin's Dan, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Because he literally is the flesh-toned Dr. Manhattan. without the hydrogen atom symbol on his forehead.
Right.
But anyway, back on topic here. inevitably, Hollywood is going to start taking a look at things like From Hell, which is far more likely to be adaptable. And the one thing Hollywood does well is not doing adaptations well.
Right.
And I think that part of it comes from some of the basic necessities. There are things that just have to happen.
Right.
You know, there's changes that must be made. I mean, I actually, decades after seeing Jaws in the movie theater, I read Peter Benchley's Jaws. Hooper, the affable marine biologist, is eviscerated in the shark cage by the great white shark.
Yes.
You don't have a little happy ending with him and Brody swimming back to Amity Island in the what would seem to be the shark bait capital of the sea. At that point, this is full of chunks of shark meat and blood. It's like they're moving targets at that point, my way of thinking. But, you know, you have to make certain changes. Also, spoiler alert, Hooper has an affair with Brody's wife.
Does he really? Because I haven't read it. Wow.
Okay. Oh, spoiler alert, Hooper spoiler. Has an affair with Brody's wife. And, yeah. So, truly, the wages of sin are death. But anyway.
Oh, God. Welcome to Alan Moore's show, everybody. Truly, right. The wages of sin are death.
But, you know, that's going to happen. You have to make necessary changes to make something approachable to a larger audience. To, you know, would Jaws have been a vastly different film had it followed the book? Absolutely. And would it have been successful? Absolutely not. So, you know, those things are going to happen. I think, you know, in the age of adaptation, everyone resigns themselves to that.
Right.
Unless they're Alan Moore. At which point, you simply, recuse yourself from the production.
You don't even just recuse yourself from the production. You kind of recuse yourself from life at that point, from your work. Because, you know, he brilliantly said, and what was, again, I'm without a quote, which is very unfortunate. Oh, here it is. You know, he channeled and he says, people tell me, don't you care what they've done to your book? And I tell them, that they haven't done anything in my book. It's right there on the shelf. They paid me for it. That's the end of it. Like, so that's it. That's it. Alan Moore says, okay, I did my work, and it is the best work I can do because, you know, that's what I do.
And there it is for all to see.
Yeah, so don't come tell me that they're ruining my work. They're ruining their work. It's just based on my work.
They're doing some crappy work based on my incredible work. Yeah, that's very well said. Because I think, though, you know, if you have heard the things like Alan Moore, you know, refusing to take credit or you know, having his name removed from films and stuff like that, it's easy to imagine that if you get that rare opportunity to talk to the man, and have him steal 7% of your soul in the process, which is the what you, it's right there in black and white. You're going to approach that very question in that way, where you're sort of like a little smarmy, like, well, they ruined your work, didn't they? And then of course he's going to be like, no, they didn't.
Right, exactly. No. This exists because of something I did. It doesn't define what I did.
It doesn't retroactively. You don't go and like, you know, I don't go to the comic rack over the trade paperback rack in my studio, and I go pull Watchmen for my multi times a year rereading. And all of a sudden, you know, Dr. Manhattan's dick's hanging to the floor, or there is no squid, or you know. These things didn't change.
Right, exactly. Because,
and, you know, you don't go and pick up your giant phone book that is the trade paperback of From Hell.
Oh, my God, right?
And, you know, none of that changes. The original work remains the same. You go and read Peter Benchley's Jaws, and there's still that unfortunate affair no one apparently knew about that I've ruined, and the death of Brody. Those things will always be there.
And, you know, I don't think it was ever... I think that... I see... It was very, very typified, I think, in what happened with... Because he started... Alan Moore started as a proponent of Hollywood. He consulted with Tim Burton on the Batman movies. He was really into it. He, you know... And I think it was when people started getting it wrong so many times in his eyes that he decided that he couldn't deal with it. And by V for Vendetta, he was out. I think he was just done. He wasn't going to have a part of it.
In many ways, V for Vendetta is a good example to bring up because it's very much like the first American Godzilla film.
Oh, my God.
Because we had something that was culturally not ours, and we had no idea what to do with it, literally. And you look at V for Vendetta, as an American, I get most of it. And perhaps it's because I watched enough British television long before Downton Abbey, because there was such a thing as British television before Downton Abbey. In America. I was familiar enough. I don't doubt that there are things that I don't get. I'm sure if a Brit came along and said, well, did you see this? I'd be like, I don't know why they were Irish.
They had to be Irish.
Why this particular British person happened to be Liam Neeson.
Well, he has a certain set of skills, Cole.
Oh, he does, including pointing out things that Americans might not have recognized in British literature.
He does that before he kills you. To torment you with great literature.
So tell me, did you notice this when you read Nicholas Nickleby?
So tell me.
Now I'm going to break your neck.
When you're a James, why would you even James Joyce's, no, like
why would you force me to read the Canterbury Tales and then kill me? Is it less like to drive me mad before I die? I don't understand. But you know, literally, I think there are things I probably wouldn't get that are there that are very steeped in British. But I got enough of it that I could have gone to see a film that was more of what was printed. No pun intended, but you know. More closely adapted from the source material, and it would have been okay.
Right.
It was not so culturally unapproachable as, say, like if you just did a shot-for-shot like they did with Psycho a few years ago, if you did a shot-for-shot remake of a Bollywood film, I'd be lost.
Right.
I think the biggest secret of Bollywood is it's like the Emperor's New Clothes. No one in India will admit they don't know what the hell's going on. But they will line up and spend their rupee faithfully.
It's true.
About that? I knew a foreign currency that was relative to the foreign land I was speaking of.
Oh my God! Yes, you did. You are showing your cosmopolitan nature tonight.
Yeah,
Cole.
Just don't ask me what the hell they spend in, say, Korea.
But you know, and it also spins off very well, I think, into some of his. And again, we will be discussing these topics in depth at a later date, sooner than later. But his political beliefs, because more recently he has become known for his socio-political outlook than even his comics, and that spun out, I think, in a big way. It became public knowledge with V for Vendetta. I think that's when everybody realized that he was extremely anti-establishment, you know, because you could see it on the screen and everybody was like, whoa, what did we just make? Like, what are we watching right now? And you said it before that that after V for Vendetta, he wanted, you know, never had he been more certain that he wanted to leave England. But the question is, if you're going to leave England, where are you going to go that's any better?
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, he's a total anarchist. In every way, he's an occultist who has created his own religion at this point. And this is where we start getting into the more crazy side. And we're not going to go, we're talking about comics for the most part. But it, you can't talk about Alan Moore without talking about the fact that, you know, that he's steeped in his own mythology. He has created this world for himself, this mythological world that he lives in, to the point where, and my, for obvious reasons, my favorite story that he tells is that he at least once he's said at least once, if not more, which we will need to do research on before we speak any further, that he has met John Constantine. He met John Constantine in Westminster. This is him. He says that he was at a sandwich bar, and then up the stairs came John Constantine. He said it was his John Constantine. That was his more docile meeting with John Constantine than anything. And there, it goes on from there, which we'll get into at a later date. But he's so steeped in his own mythology that it's pretty amazing. He's an amazing man, and he's done some extremely amazing things. No more so than his outlooks on political science. Like rarely do you get a comic book creator who comes out as being an anarchist. You know, that's
just absolutely vehemently so.
You couldn't ask me what Grant Morrison's stance on the Arab Spring was, and I could tell you. But I'm pretty sure I could tell you what Alan Moore says.
Exactly.
And that's amazing. That's great. Like, I love the fact that he is so wildly transparent that he makes no qualms about who he is. And
I think he can, unlike most, he can afford to be, because if you already have a reputation for being completely nuts, then, you know, who's going to come in and challenge you on anything? Because it's like fear the beard, you know?
Right.
Hashtag fear the beard.
That's very true. And with all that, I think we're coming close to needing to bring the show to a close. We have talked for an hour on Alan Moore and have not even begun to scratch the surface on Alan Moore.
We haven't even begun to talk about Alan Moore, really.
I mean, the dude wrote a screenplay with Malcolm McLaren, who was the Sex Pistols manager. Like, there's just so much to talk about. Like,
well, I mean, and also some of the earliest stuff when I started, like, looking for Alan Moore, because, you know, Watchmen got... When DC picked up V for Vendetta and completed it, because Warrior went out of business before that was completed, brought back the original artist, and Moore came back to a project he hadn't touched in over a decade, maybe longer, and, you know, said, I'm just going to go forward and forget about all the things I would have changed. I'm not going to change the things that were wrong. And the only thing I can say that glaringly exists in V for Vendetta that I would think probably falls into that category is a mention during the broadcast of The Voice of Fate.
Right.
Of a princess, somebody or other, making a public appearance. And I don't think that in a fascist England, royalism or... Is that a word, royalism? But I don't think you would have a royal family, even as a figurehead, in any fashion.
Right, you wouldn't have a monarchy.
Yeah, there wouldn't even be a pretend monarchy. That would have long since been swept away by Norse fire. And I think that that's, which was the name of the original the political party, was Norse fire. And they would have eliminated all of that in their,
right.
in their blind, you know...
Hubris, if you will.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that, you know, it's so minor that it really, there are probably people who've read V for Vendetta like, wow, you know, I never thought of that. And others are like, yeah, that bothered me, and then here's the litany of things that he did wrong. But, you know, I remember when it was announced, like, that's that mask thing from Warrior Magazine.
Right,
that
right.
I ignored way back when. And then, you know, First Comics was publishing Miracle Man. And later put it out in trade paperbacks. It was good luck affording those because all of a sudden they became worth a fortune.
Right.
And I don't know who I loaned all of mine to, but they never gave them back. That will haunt me forever. But at any rate, you know, these were the things that I sort of stumbled on later. And, you know, I started seeking out Alan Moore, as I mentioned earlier. And then there were things that just... The thing with someone who's that prolific is then you discover they have a body of work you don't give a damn about.
Right.
Like there's some sort of, I'm sure it was meant to be kind of like a humor thing with these characters, DR and Quench, who were kind of these bizarre looking alien characters, often prone to wear either a t-shirt or a button or something that would say like, nuke your parents.
Right, right,
they were
right.
All the ever belligerent, ever angry, ever rebellious.
The angry anarchists. Yeah.
And I thought, you know, looking back on that, that was probably a very, you know, British angst kind of thing.
The Lost Boysian angst.
Yeah, it was kind of like the cover of a Constantine one time, which, of course, he had nothing to do with this particular Constantine, but, that you know, they had this... The image was, of course, John Constantine. In the background, you saw a poster, like a... election poster of Margaret Thatcher, and it was just done to look like there was someone who had done in graffiti across it, voting Tory is hazardous to your health. And it's one of those things where, you know, that's probably even funnier if you're British.
Right, right.
Especially if you were anti-Thatcher.
Yeah, if you were anti-hardline at that point, right.
Yeah, so, but, I mean, there are 100 things to talk about, and... You know, it was something that back when we were kind of coming up with some of the concepts that would be part of upcoming issues of this show, there are so many things that don't ever occur to us way back when. I mean, there's things we have in mind, or sometimes we're like, what were we even going to do? literally, we'll kind of get into some of our episodes, we're like, did we even know what we were talking about back when we put this on the list? Because it'll be like 7 months later.
Right.
But in this case, I don't think, you know, it just seemed like creator spotlights. We'll do this character, this character, this character. And then all of a sudden you get up to Alan Moore, you're like, this creator, this author. Yeah. And you get there and you realize this one is way too big. You can't touch on enough of Alan Moore in an hour. And they were like, okay, so Andy today says, okay, this has to be a story arc. So we're gonna backburner it. We're like, okay, we're going to do a story arc, and we'll just shelve the creator spotlight until maybe John Byrne, perhaps.
Right.
Though we didn't even know that at the time. So, you know, then it was like, no, we're going to go forward, and we're going to use this to whet the appetite for a future. In several weeks, we're going to begin a new story arc called More on More. And that is... M-O-R-E space O-N M-O-O-R-E. We're not saying the least bit that Alan Moore's a moron.
Right.
Because I fear the beard.
Yeah, he's here. He's with us always. So you have to... But, you know, no, it was one of those things where, you know, in classic fashion, I start researching and I'm looking at stuff for Alan Moore, and I'm putting together lists of internet, you know, site links and ideas, and, you know, starting to get the nebulous cloud of, you know, of what we will end up talking about. And I'm amazed. Like 5 minutes, 10 minutes into the research, and I've got like 20 sites that we're going to have to go through fully to get the grasp of what's going on. And it was one of those moments where we've talked about on the show before, where I'm like, hey, I think there's 5 issues in this. And I'm like, and unlike Cole would usually come back and be like, I don't know if we can, you know, even do 1 issue on this, let alone 5. He's like, yes. He's like, yeah. Yes, there is. So
we could just do like a whole, we just switch gears and just be the, you know, Alan Moore cast. Tonight's the 5-issue outlook on Moorecast.
That's right.
So that's Moorecast.
So in a couple more issues, then we're going to jump into Alan Moore wholesale. We're going to really dig in to all of the things that we've talked about tonight. Everything from his occultism to the legends and lore surrounding him, to his comic work, to his political outlook, like just everything we can possibly get into. We're going to dig up into that beard and make a nest and live there for 5 hours. It's going to be amazing. I could not be more looking forward to this. It's going to be so much fun. But I think in my closing thought for this, the true man that Alan Moore is, who he is, he created V for Vendetta, and V for Vendetta featured the main prantagonist. I just invented a word.
Prantagonist.
The anti-hero had a Guy Fawkes mask.
Yeah.
Because of the the Gunpowder Revolution.
The November 5th attempt to overthrow the government.
Right.
Guy Fawkes and a number of other conspirators were planning to blow up Parliament, and they'd packed the basement with dynamite. Something went awry. I've forgotten. I don't know my British history that well, but ultimately Fawkes himself was the only conspirator caught and was hanged for his crimes, and it became tradition for especially loyalists, I'm sure, and to sort of, keep a good stiff upper lip and God and country and all that, hip hip, to burn Guy Fawkes in effigy. So we can assume that Guy Fawkes himself favored a mustache and goatee similar to that of V for Vendetta.
Correct.
In a strange sort of time bullet retro history, where in reality, kids, Guy Fawkes existed long before even Alan Moore was born.
But here's the amazing thing, is that you have now the adaptation of the Guy Fawkes mask that was an adaptation of the gun, you know, the 5th of November Revolution being adapted into the anonymous culture, this legion of, you know, of anarchists that have taken sort of vigilante societal justice into their own hands. So while I make a point on the 5th of November to throw it out there that, you know your history, kids, you know, why you're wearing the mask, Alan Moore has never, it's as far as I know, publicly said, guys, I was responsible for you wearing these masks. I just want to make sure. No, not at all. Just, I'm going to sit back and let this happen.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is the absolute epitome of the man that is Alan Moore. Like, he could, every chance he gets.
Oh, yeah. Well, it could be an annual thing.
He could lapeled it and be out there saying, yeah.
Might I remind you
right.
yet again.
Right, I've licensed and marketed this mask, and you can no longer, you know, like any number of things, but nope.
Oh yeah, they kind of Disneyed it, and, you know, like when they forced that guy who had the giant Mickey Mouse stormtrooper helmet artist guy, they've now won their court battle to make him stop using his Mickey Mouse esque thing.
You
know,
right.
You could have had more in DC going after everybody and saying, no, you can dress up in a foppish hat and a dark tunic every Halloween, and maybe hang on to it for a couple of days. But beyond that, you can't go and use this for your movement or for, you know, hijacking websites of creeps and things like that.
Exactly, exactly. So that to me is the man himself. I don't. What are your final thoughts on this? Outside of what we're going to get into in the story,
and that I'm very anxious because we are going to be breaking down and more precisely zeroing in on some of the works and some of the stuff we just don't have time to talk about. But I have to say that I think in many ways a combination of Alan Moore and Frank Miller changed everything in comics for a good long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, to this day, there's this constant drift and this ebb and flow. But every now and again, done right, there's a reminder that, you know, I think the takeaway from Alan Moore is, if I'm not entirely mistaken, he may be the only comic creator to have his work listed in the top 100 works of literature.
Wow, okay.
Of all time, as selected by whoever decided that they were self-important enough to make that distinction for the rest of us. But there was actually several years ago, I forget whose list it was, but it, much like the, there was the big top 100 film, IFC top 100 films, whatever body is similar to that in literature had pretty much declared, here are the most top 100 most important works of literature ever. And, you know, when a comic book is being, you know, put in the stacks amongst dusty tomes with leather binding and gold leaf pages, and you know, that's pretty impressive.
Right.
That says something that the comic book had arrived.
Exactly. And I think that is another thing that he really did was hearken. He was a herald of the arrival of the comic book as serious literature. And we can't, on Hey Kids Comics, we can't be more thankful for that.
Needless to say, it gives us something to talk about on a constant basis and gives me a recurring theme to bring up as a a tongue-in-cheek thorn in Andy's side.
No, I love it. You get so excited when we can talk about Watchmen. I absolutely love it. And I think that if we were to give our listeners required Alan Moore reading, Watchmen would be at the top of that list, followed by V for Vendetta, followed by From Hell, followed by The Killing Joke, followed by League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, followed by that damn DC collected work of Alan Moore, followed by his work on Images Supreme of all things, which was brilliant, followed by Top 10, followed by, you know, you just anything. If it says Alan Moore and the spine, buy it.
It's certainly going to be worth checking out. Promethea and Tom Strong were both a bit, this didn't capture me in the way Top 10 did. And so it's just arriving at just the right angle. But for the most part, most of the things I've ever encountered were very satisfying. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the second volume, at first seemed a bit, it just seemed like he was phoning it in. And then I finally went back and reread it.
Yes.
Granted, the first issue became very much like that much contested issue of Daredevil.
Yes.
In which he has to sort of vaguely suggest some Edgar Rice Burroughs characters that are kind of not public domain. Kind of know who he's talking about, and then you kind of wonder why John Carter is bald.
Right.
But then, once you get into it, and once you realize what he's doing, and once you get past the unique take that I'd have to actually go back and reread Island of Dr. Moreau after all these years, to see why it just seemed like, you know, the Moreau's menagerie were all dressed in children's book costumes. But that may well have been the case. I don't remember if they were clothed as well as remade in humanoid form. Willow, change me back to my human form.
Shit! Wow!
How many years I've been waiting to pull that one out. But, you know, once you get into that, and then you realize that ultimately it is, Alan Moore plays a long game.
Mm-hmm.
And League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Volume 2, I will tell you right now, is a long game with a a surprisingly satisfying payoff.
Good, good. I need to go back and reread it again. It's been a long time since I did that.
Yeah, I felt obliged once after rereading Leo Extraordinary Gentleman. I felt like I owed it to the second volume to read it for some reason, like it knew.
Like it was judging you from the bookshelf.
It was, you know.
It is Alan Moore's work,
because
so.
Because the parts per million of Alan Moore's beard in every every publication is significant enough that it can shame you from across the sea. And I came away from it with a whole different, I'm like, wow, I should have actually read this when I was buying individual issues at a higher price than the combined, the total cost of this collected.
Right. All right. Let's plug this up and get out of here.
I was going to go on record and say, buy, collect, read, and enjoy Alan Moore.
I think that that's the best idea. And if you can collect Alan Moore, more power to you.
That's right. Collect all one. So with that, this is, of course, coming to you through the beardly auspices of the Jedi Cole universe at JediCole.com. You can look for some tweets. I'm actually getting around to doing a tweet tonight about an upcoming event. The Jedi Cole universe has been on August 11th, 2015, in Arlington, Texas, at the Bob Duncan Center in Vandergrift Park, off of Center Street, I believe, between Center and Madlock. You can attend if you're so inclined. The Jedi Cole Universe Comic, Toy, and Collectible Swap Meet. A one-day event, all-day Saturday, with some amazing vendors. The dealer room is filling up at an alarming rate, and we have an invitational artist alley, which I can now officially announce.
Nice.
And this is going to be just really cool. Some great friends of the show are involved. Role to Play is diligently researching where they want to be in the room.
Yes, they are.
Love you, Tiffany. Thank you for rolling the dice, as it were, for being a part of the show. Galaxy Call Dallas will be joining us. Yak's Pub.
That is amazing.
The amazing Scott Horn will be joining us on toys and prints from Yak's Pub, and the incredible Yak's Pub Heimlich, Stormtrooper Heimlich maneuver poster. Seminal favorite.
Yes.
You can find out about that and other great comic shows and places you can see me pop up, including the upcoming Texas Comic Fest, which will be coming up in June. The JCU will have a booth there. The JCU will also, a little bit earlier in May, will be appearing at the very least at A Galaxy Called Dallas in Garland. And you can find out about that on the JCU, on the Jedi Universe website, or about the conventions and other fun stuff on Convention Awareness Project Texas at cap-tx.info. Our Twitter is the Jedi Cole U. And you can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. And we are going to be very soon over at the Casa de Jedi Cole. We are diligently hollowing out space to create a little video production studio.
Yes, you are.
So we can do some fine half-ass productions for the new Jedi Cole Universe half-ass video network, and new shows, including Fandom at Random DFW.
There you go. Yeah. If they wanted to get more information on your on the Jedi Cole swap meet, where would they go to do that?
Well, the Jedi Cole Universe is going to be all over that mother.
Right.
There is going to be a committed website, which is still in the works, because it's been less than a week that I decided to go ahead and make this happen. So things are moving a little slow there, but as of today, there is now a Facebook page.
Nice.
Which is under the Jedi Cole Universe. I think it's under the under JCU Swap Meet. But you can also, if you just look up the Jedi Cole Universe Comic, Toy, and Collectible Swap Meet, or just get enough of that in there for it'll just prompt itself on up for you. You can get some information on that. That page will be updated constantly, and I want to thank our good friend Daniel Calhoun, a.k.a. Captain Ameridad,
whose birthday is the day that this comes out. So happy birthday, Daniel.
Happy birthday, Daniel. And thank you for joining us as the official spokesman and spokes model and spokes Captain America of the comic toy and collectible swap meet.
That's awesome. That's perfect. Yeah, you can do that. We're going to be also at Galaxy Call Dallas for New Comic Book Day as well.
Free
New Comic. We're going to be there for New Comic Book. I only buy comics once a year on Free Comic Book Day. That is my New Comic Book Day. I just go in and I drop $10,000. I just buy, these are new, right? Okay, I'll buy them.
We at Hey Kids Comics discourage you from having an annual New Comic Book Day.
That's true.
We would rather have weekly, monthly, or
daily.
Works out best for you, but please, do not do it yearly. Like bathing, it should be done more than once.
That's right. That's right. So yes, we'll be there. We're going to be all over the place in the coming months. So prepare yourself for that. We should get out of here, man. Is Lubicon going to be involved in the swap meet?
I believe they are. I need to check with Danae, but she's been certainly throwing a lot of love the swap meets away, so I have a feeling that's going to be...
Well, it's not like we're not going to let her one way or another, so...
I'm just going to say right now, if you're listening today, there will be a table for you free of charge to...
Boom! Free of charge for the swap meet.
The swap meet. You can be set up there on the stage and enjoy the, being part of the show. And
Lubicon coming February of next year. It is going to be amazing. I am not allowed to divulge any new information that I might be privy to, but it is shaping up to be one hell of a show. Vendor apps are still available. I know some people have signed vendor apps, so I know that they are going. You should sign up and get your table now, but you have a chance.
That's going to fill up fast. If you're keen on doing the tabletop show in Arlington in August, there's a lot of good 8-foot by 2.5-foot tables left. That's right, 8 linear feet.
8 linear feet. Suck it, everyone else in
so
the world.
Suck it shows that only give you 6 linear feet.
That's right.
And maybe a price you will not believe if paid before June 26th.
If postmarked by June 26th. All right, so next week we are going to have a show called, House of Obscurity.
That's correct.
And we're going to delve into a lot of more obscure titles, hopefully open your world a little more. I'm sure that Alan Moore will be brought up on that show as well, because it's brought up on every show we do. So until next week, like Cole said, buy, collect, and enjoy your Alan Moore. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
And Alan
Moore. Good night, Alan Moore's beard.
Thank you. Good night, Moore. Good night, Alan Moore's beard. Good night, listeners.
Many ways to